Huge news in the Lowcountry. Alex Murdoch, wounded, disgraced, and in detox, now facing charges in connection with his own shooting. The one-time heir to a legal dynasty, tonight, mere hours away from arrest. Plus, you've been served. The lawsuit from the woman alleging sexual assault against Prince Andrew just took a major step forward. Her lawyer joins us tonight. And the mysterious disappearance of Gabby Petito, her fiancé, now officially a person of interest, as a police report details a violent fight between them in Utah. Tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield, the latest bombshell in the sordid and sprawling Murdoch saga blew up just a short time ago. Word of an arrest warrant with Alex Murdoch's name on it and a charge of conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. No arrest has taken place just yet. Rather, Murdoch is expected to turn himself in from his out-of-state inpatient detox treatment tomorrow. His own attorney, one of them, acknowledged this morning that charges were a foregone conclusion after last night's arrest of Murdoch's alleged partner in crime, the man he hired to allegedly bump him off a week ago Saturday so that his surviving son, Buster, could collect a whopping insurance payout. This allegedly is the man we're talking about, Curtis Edward Smith. He's better known as Eddie. And not only is he allegedly Murdoch's clearly incompetent hitman, he is a former client of Murdoch, the lawyer, and also allegedly Murdoch's former main source of his drug of choice, Oxy, to which he's been addicted for years now, and for which he entered rehab 9 days ago. Eddie Smith also happens to be Cousin Eddie, a distant relative of the Murdochs. Smith's charges are numerous. Assisted suicide, although yes, Murdoch didn't die. Assault and battery of a high and aggravated nature. Pointing and presenting a firearm. Insurance fraud and conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. I have to take a breath because believe me, there's more, a lot more. I want you to hear from Murdoch's attorney, Dick Harpootlian. He's a former South Carolina state senator, and I want you to hear what he has to say about the events leading up to Alex Murdoch's brush with death on an otherwise quiet Saturday on Old Sakahatchee Road.
The murder of his son and wife 90 days ago took a tremendous toll on him. His father died of cancer that same week. Most people couldn't get through that. He got through it with the use of opioids, and then last week, a week ago, actually, it was uncovered that he had converted some client and law firm money to his own use and again, spent most of that on opioids. And on that Saturday morning, he was trying to get off the opioids. He was not taking any of them. Was in a massive depression. Realized that things were going to get very, very, very bad, and he decided to end his life.
Well, that's a lot of admissions right there. But here is how the state police put it in their affidavit supporting Cousin Eddie's arrest warrant. Never has an affidavit read more like a John Grisham novel. Get seated. Co-defendant Richard Alexander Murdoch conspired with Curtis Edward Smith in the area of Old Sakahatchee Road for the purpose of Mr. Smith assisting Mr. Murdoch to commit suicide. Note the description there of Murdoch as co-defendant, even though he hadn't yet been charged. It goes on. Mr. Murdoch provided Mr. Smith with a firearm and then directed Mr. Smith to shoot him in the head for the purpose of causing Mr. Murdoch's death and allowing for the payment of a stated death benefit to a beneficiary. On September 4th, 2021, Mr. Smith followed Mr. Murdoch to Old Sakahatchee Road and shot Mr. Murdoch as he stood in the roadway. After shooting Mr. Murdoch in the head, Mr. Smith drove to an unknown location where he disposed of the firearm. On September 13th, 2021, that's Monday of this week, Mr. Murdoch provided a statement to SLED admitting to the scheme of having Mr. Smith murder him for the purpose of his son collecting a life insurance policy valued at approximately $10 million. On September 14th, Mr. Smith admitted to being present during the shooting of Mr. Murdoch, interesting word, being present, and to disposing of the firearm afterwards. I said there's more, and I meant it. Today, the State Law Enforcement Division, it's better known as SLED, well, they announced a brand new criminal investigation, this one, into the 2018 death of the Murdoch's family longtime housekeeper, Gloria Satterfield. At the time, Satterfield's death was blamed on a trip and fall at the Murdoch residence, and Alex Murdoch's insurance company paid out $500,000 to settle a wrongful death claim. Now the county coroner says, hold it. There are a whole lot of things that don't add up. And by the way, Satterfield's sons agree. They're now suing for the money they say they never saw. And this just in, their brand new attorney says it wasn't $500,000. Eric Bland actually says it was close to $2 million. That is brand new tonight, folks. Let me bring in my panel. Andrew Davis is an investigative correspondent for WSAV in Savannah. Susan E. Williams is a defense attorney and former South Carolina prosecutor. And Mark O'Mara is a criminal defense attorney and civil rights attorney. To the three of you, welcome, Andrew Davis. I'll begin with you. I don't even know where to begin, actually. There's that breaking news that the settlement was closer to $2 million, and those boys, the children of the housekeeper who slipped and fell, haven't seen a penny. But the law firm of their attorney back then, who was best friends with Alex Murdoch and also worked with them at the law firm and also was Paul Murdoch's godfather, they got paid close to $200,000. And then there's all this business about what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm going to give you some information from Jim Griffin real quickly. This is from the attorney for Alex Murdoch, sent to me. We've been informed that there's a warrant for his arrest for conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. He plans to voluntarily surrender tomorrow, and the arraignment and the bond hearing will be held at 4 p.m. at the Hampton County Magistrate Court. Andrew Davis, it's a lot to take in.
It is a lot to take in. One of the things that I noticed immediately was when Mr. Harpootlian was talking this morning, he said that Alec called Mr. Smith a half hour before this shooting happened and said, would you go ahead and kill me? And somehow Mr. Smith said, sure, that's fine. I will do that. The timing doesn't seem right on that one when you think this would be a plotted out kind of situation. They also were talking deeply about the drug addiction that he had and how it was all based on this and that they had never spoken to him when he was clean. And suddenly when they did, they found about this plot and immediately called SLED, which sounds like a preemptive strike as much as anything to me when you're looking at that situation. Right now, I think there's a lot of questions on why now, and everybody wants to know why only this one charge. My understanding is this is the way to go ahead and get him in, to go ahead and get him in front of a judge to get that charge against him, and then the future charges will be there. A lot of the 911 people, the first responders I spoke to, said they want to see him charged with making a false report as well, because that was a lot of time. An effort that was spent by a lot of people in Hampton County and with SLED just to figure out that this was all a hoax to begin with.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind charging him with, like, you know, what he did to the media and the public by stringing us all along with a bunch of lies and you know, no, be on the lookout, but there's some attempted murderer out there. It's very frustrating. By the way, you touched on something, and I want to play this moment. It happened on the Today Show. It was about the hitman that we were just talking about. Dick Harpootlian, that's Alex Murdoch's lawyer and also a former state senator and also used to be the lawyer for Paul in the boat crash. I need a breath. He said about that hitman that this is somehow all about him and his fault, and poor Alex in all of this alleged conspiracy is a victim. I'm going to let him explain it, but have a listen to Dick Harpootlian this morning on the Today Show referring to that.
He called this guy who met him on the side of the road, agreed to shoot him in the head, and this fake car breakdown. 30 minutes later, this guy shooting him in the head. Didn't try to persuade him not to do it. Didn't hesitate at all.
Susan Williams, again, I don't think this is a cultural difference between, regions of the country. I just think that's horrible to suggest that, somehow Alex Murdoch, who has admitted that he wanted to hire the guy so that he could get $10 million for his son, is now apparently being taken advantage of for his mental health. This just doesn't sit right.
Ashley, I'm not buying what these folks are trying to sell. Alex has already told some lies, and once that happens, we're supposed to magically start believing what he says now. I mean, you have someone who hires a hitman who cannot, for the life of him, no pun intended,
right,
shoot Alex and kill him as he was intended to do. They're making Alex out to be the poor victim here. And let's think about this. There are plenty of victims here. People who have suffered real deaths, people who really are grieving. They're not playing around with police and their jobs and, wasting the state's resources on getting a helicopter and making up these stories and then deciding later on, oh, never mind. I don't know what I
wanted. Wanted the money. Yeah, I wanted the money. So, okay, Mark O'Meara, I'm going to go through the list of charges that the alleged co-conspirator here is facing. It's long. It's assisted suicide, assault and battery of a high and aggravated nature, pointing and presenting a firearm, insurance fraud, and conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. But the word from, everyone is that the only charge that Alex 2 days later is going to be facing is the insurance fraud business. Okay, so walk me through that, understanding fully that charges can always follow later, but the optics on this stink.
It stinks, but I think it's intentional. We can't presume that all of a sudden Alec is now going to be treated as the criminal that he seems to be. I mean, he has had a privileged life for his entire life and for the couple of generations before him. And now what he does, and I try not to run to Speculationville, which this case almost demands you to, but he runs off to treatment for his ongoing opiate addiction, thereby giving himself some type of an excuse for at least what he was doing. He was so depressed, that's why he wanted to kill himself. I've said this to you, Ashley, before. We are nowhere near done with this book. I think we're going to have some revelations as far as the investigation into the death of the mom and son. May well be that Murdaugh was trying some last-ditch effort to maintain the integrity or the dignity of his name way back then. We don't know where this is going, but the idea that the distant cousin is going to be charged with several offenses more than Alec, the one who we now know, if in all common sense tells us, was the one who created all of this. It's sort of absurd, but it may just be a continuation of the way the Murdaugh family is still being treated.
Cousin Eddie. I mean, could we get another twist in this story? Cousin Eddie, who's in lockup and got bonded out today for $5,000, I heard out of his mouth while he was jittering away. Who bonded me out? So somehow, Cousin Eddie, who's allegedly the drug dealer for Alec Murdoch, Cousin Alec, doesn't even know who put up the $5,000 to get him out of jail today, but he was bonded out this afternoon. Guys, stay put, if you would, for a moment, as we see these pictures of Cousin Eddie, courtesy of WYFF News 4. They got these shots of him being transited between the van and the lockup. It's just sort of hard to believe. But how about this? A coroner who actually says, I don't know about that death of the Murdoch housekeeper. The cause of death, actually, the words used was manner of death, was said to be natural. Well, guess what? There's no such thing as a manner of death that's natural. And there ain't nothing natural about tripping and falling to your death. We're going to get into that in a moment. Welcome back. We are looking ahead into the next stop in Alex Murdoch's spiral of pain. That would be the Hampton County Courthouse to answer a charge of conspiracy to commit insurance fraud by hiring a distant cousin and former client to kill him so that his son Buster could collect $10 million. The alleged accomplice botched it all, and he's charged, too, with several offenses that Alex Murdaugh will certainly not be able to get him out of. I'm joined again by Andrew Davis of WSAV-TV and the brilliant attorney Susan E. Williams and Mark O'Mara. Okay, so interestingly, Andrew Davis, there is this whole notion that, and I think I misspoke earlier by saying the manner of death was natural. Earlier, I saw a report that the coroner had said the cause of death was natural, which is crazy, but I sure hope they used manner of death. It just seemed very odd to me that back then they wouldn't have had a report. No one would have done a report, that a judge would have signed off on any kind of settlement. But now we're hearing that the people who have taken over the descendants of the dead housekeeper, those two boys, have a new lawyer named Eric Bland. And he has said that the settlement wasn't $500,000. It was more like $2 million. So now I'm wondering what the investigation's all about that's been announced today by SLED. Is it about the money and where is it? Because boys didn't see any of it. Or is it about how she really died? Do we know what the actual investigation is?
We actually think it's both right now. It's about the money, but it's also about that manner of death that you spoke of, because there are still questions about exactly how she died and what happened afterwards. This was by the Hampton County coroner opened this, as well as SLED saying, also information that we have gotten during this investigation, speaking of the murder investigation with the Murdaughs, with Maggie and Paul Murdaugh, and this current shooting investigation too. So they now suddenly have connected this. They said the exact same thing with Stephen Smith, the young man who died back in 2015, who was hit by a car in a hit and run, supposedly, but the Murdaugh name has been tied back to that case as well. And that was once again reopened during this situation when they were looking at more information while looking into the murder case. So clearly SLED is now tying the pieces together to figure out what may have happened, what may have been hidden. And this is all about the money. They put the money in the pockets and everybody just let it go from there. But now that the money's gone, everybody's starting to ask a lot more questions.
So I have one more piece of information I want to play for you from the Today Show today. And it has to do with Dick Harpootlian, the lawyer for Alex Murdaugh, talking back about the original thing that brought this whole thing into the press. And that was the death of Paul and Maggie, the shooting death of Paul and Maggie. And it's about a suspect, because nobody's ever heard of anybody, right? No one's heard of anyone who might be looked at, a person of interest, just nothing. And it's 90 days since Paul and Maggie died. And here's Dick Harpootlian talking about, I don't know, being Columbo or something. I don't know what it is, but he's telling the Today Show that he thinks he might know who killed Paul and Maggie. Have a look.
Jim Griffin and I are working on and investigating an individual or individuals we believe may have some culpability or had done it. And we're in the process of doing that. We're not SWED. We're not law enforcement. We don't have their tools. But we think we'll know this week whether the one suspect we're looking at bears further scrutiny, and we'll make that information available to law enforcement.
Susan E. Williams, I just sort of dropped my Cheerios. What do you mean you know and you're going to tell SLED? Can you work me through that one?
Well, I noticed the one thing he did not mention was the Mallory Beach lawsuit is still pending, and Alec is named as a defendant, and it has not been settled. And I keep going back to that because Mallory Beach's estate has not been made whole, and the mediation failed miserably, and somebody's going to have to end up paying that wrongful death lawsuit, presumably, because Alex Insurance Company isn't going to cover, they're saying, the boat insurance.
Part of it. Yeah, part of it. I've heard that other insurance has actually come through, so it may be a partial thing, but it's a bit of a mess. There are a lot of insurance companies. Real quickly, Mark O'Mara, I just can't believe, first of all, a lawyer would go on television and, convict his client on all those things, because he didn't even, like, couch the stealing all the money from the law firm. He just said, yeah, that happened. But then, you know, there's this whole notion of tomorrow he's got an arraignment, apparently the bond hearing, 4 p.m., what's going to happen? In legal speak, does he get to just show up, say, okay, I'm here, bond out and go back to rehab? Or will there be something a little more serious than that, Mark?
No, I think the former, not the latter. I think he's going to show up. I think he's going to get a bond. And I think he's going to go back to rehab because that's the safest place for him from a defense, you know, perspective, keep him in rehab. That's his only excuse for most all of this while SLED continues to do all their investigations. I don't think they're looking into the cause of death on the housekeeper because there's so little difference forensically between, you know, a trip and a fall and a push. But I do think they're looking at the money, and they're going to try and follow the money through. And that's going to be one of the seedier parts about all of this is where the money went through, the money coming out of the law firm. You don't spend $5 million on opiates. I don't care how addicted you are.
Right.
But we're going to, again, there's a lot more to see, a lot more chapters for them to write and for us to read and try to comment on.
You're right about that. There's no way you can spend $5 million on opiates. Rush Limbaugh, I think, was taking 100 or 200 pills a day, and he didn't do anything like that. That's just nuts. And then the weirder part is that it turns out he didn't even need a hitman. He could have actually taken his own life and still gotten the insurance payout. So he had all those opiates. I kind of think, anyway. Guys, I sure hope that I can get you all back here. You've been terrific. Thank you. Andrew Davis, Susan Williams, and Mark O'Mara. I appreciate it. Coming up, there is a legal war in the making, but a war is made up of a lot of battles, and in this case, it's a battle royale. For the attorney, for Virginia Giuffre, in the lawsuit alleging sexual assault against Prince Andrew, this battle may just be starting. He's going to join us next to talk about a recent victory, even though the war has just begun. Andrew is getting the royal treatment tonight, only it didn't come from a butler or a valet. It came from someone blue collar, and it didn't involve that fancy service that he's used to. It involved legal service, the kind where a process server says you got served right before they toss a lawsuit at you. As of today, the prince at last has officially been served with a lawsuit by a woman who's a now grown woman, but says the prince raped her when she was just 17. The UK high authorities have finally ruled that it was jolly good. It was just fine when a process server left the paperwork with the palace security guards at the gate. After all, how the heck was he supposed to get past that? Now it's on to what comes next in the case. Virginia Giuffre alleges that she was forced to have sex with the Duke of York because she was ordered to do so by Jeffrey Epstein, an old pal of Prince Andrew's. Epstein's now dead, but his right-hand woman, Ghislaine Maxwell, is alive and well and sitting in a New York jail cell facing criminal charges that aren't too far off from what Virginia Giuffre is alleging happened to her. Joining us now is the attorney for Virginia Giuffre, who you may remember from his outstanding work in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court battle for the presidency back in 2000. Welcome, David Boies. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you. Good to be here.
So I am guessing this was excellent news. You're behind all the fussiness of how to serve a royal, right? So now he's been served. What comes next?
Right. Well, what comes next is now he has to go to court and he has to really face his accuser and defend himself against the charges. This is something that we have been working at for a long time. It's been a hurdle to get here. He's had a lot of palaces to hide behind and in, but he has been finally served, and now he has to come forward and face the music.
So that, to me, says he will actually walk into a court. But at the time of COVID, I sort of think, well, people do this, you know, virtually, so you could do that from England. But will it actually mean that His Royal Highness has to walk into a Manhattan courtroom?
Eventually, he will. Initially, he won't have to come to court. Initially, he'll send his lawyers to court and we'll argue a number of legal issues. And there will be what is described as discovery. Where each side produces documents to the other. Each side has an opportunity to examine under oath the other. He'll have a chance to examine Virginia Giuffre. We'll have an opportunity to examine him. Each of us will have an opportunity to examine potential witnesses. And then we will get to court, the actual jury trial, when he'll have to face a jury and explain his conduct.
So there's the, you know, $64,000 question. Jury trial, because most people assume that eventually things just settle. But this is the prince, and there is that lady named the queen who would think nothing. Right. I mean, there would not be a chance that there'd be a settlement and an admission that this kind of thing happens. So do you fully expect, David Boies, you're going to end up in front of a judge with this?
I believe this case is going to go to trial. The charges are very serious. Virginia believes that this is a case in which she's seeking not only vindication for herself, but she's seeking to send a message that this kind of conduct is simply unacceptable, that rich and powerful people taking advantage of vulnerable young girls is something that just cannot go on. And she has dedicated herself for the last several years to trying to bring this to people's attention and to try to bring the people who have engaged in this conduct to account, not just for their sake or for her sake, but for the sake of all of the potential young girls out there that this could happen to unless something is done.
Well, moods are very different, certainly across this country, when it comes to sexual assault reporting. The Me Too movement has made juries maybe perhaps a little bit more sympathetic now to these kinds of claims. It's not just, it has to be she said, she said, she said, she said, and the list goes on to maybe, you know, get someone to think we should report it. But for his part, the prince, you know, his legal team has put out a statement during this whole serving process saying, we believe that this is a baseless, non-viable, and potentially unlawful lawsuit. And I know that often makes opposing counsel laugh, but the truth is there any shot that he has to pull off any of those three things, baseless or non-viable or unlawful, or is that all dispensed with now that he's been served?
I think that's all rhetoric. If they really thought this was a baseless, non-viable lawsuit, they wouldn't have been hiding so long. They wouldn't have been trying to evade service for so long. They would have come into court and demonstrated that it was baseless. I think that that was rhetoric. I think that's part of a PR strategy. I don't think that's a viable litigation strategy. The fact of the matter is, we have pictures. We have testimony. We have witnesses. And in a court of law, that's what counts. Evidence is what counts, not PR spin, not characterizations, not sort of bland denials. What counts is evidence. And I think the evidence is what he's going to have to confront.
So, okay, then there's this little complication. Some people call it a wrinkle. Other people call it much ado about nothing. And that is this document that his lawyers wanted to get their hands on, presumably from the Ghislaine Maxwell matter. And you'll have to, you know, disabuse me of that if that's not true. But it's a document that purports to say in the settlement where Ghislaine Maxwell and Virginia Giuffre settled their case that anybody in the inner circle of Jeffrey Epstein is kind of inoculated from being implicated in anything else. So then you've got the prince who likes to say, I barely knew the guy. But that would put him outside the inner circle and expose him to you. And then you've got the queen who's probably saying, don't you dare say that you're in his inner circle. Is this the conundrum that you're kind of hoping for, David Boies?
Well, first of all, the document they're talking about, the so-called release, does not apply to Prince Andrew in any respect. The release is limited. I can't go into the details because it's confidential, but the release on its face is limited and would exclude it. Second, as you point out, for him to take advantage of that release, he's got to say, I was one of the co-conspirators. I was part of the sex trafficking. I just can't believe that he is going to be prepared to do that. I would be surprised if that was something that the queen would tolerate. Certainly, if he comes forward and admits that he was part of the inner circle, that he was part of the sex trafficking in order to take advantage of this this so-called release, that to a large extent accomplishes our goal of holding him to account of getting him to admit his conduct. So I think he is on the horns of a dilemma. I think this is much more lawyer and PR spin than it is the kind of thing that he will actually use in the courtroom.
On the horns of dilemma, I sense that could be a Netflix special, or maybe the headline or the cover of the book you may write after this. David Boies, it's always good to see you. I look forward to having a chance to talk with you further on this case and others. I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely. It's good to talk to you.
You too. We have some major developments to bring you in the case of a 22-year-old woman who went missing while driving cross-country with her fiancé in a van and sharing the trip on social media. He has now been named a person of interest in the case. And just as police released a report, or at least a police report has surfaced, describing a violent confrontation between the couple just before she disappeared. Where is Gabby Petito? The 22-year-old vanished last month while driving cross-country in a van with her fiancé, Brian Laundrie. They left New York on July 2nd and were posting updates on social media as they headed westward across the country. And it was really a great feed. That was until August 25th, when the posts abruptly stopped. 6 days after that, the man on the left, Brian, curiously rolled up in that white van into his parents' driveway in Florida. Gabby's white van. No sign of Gabby. On top of that, he wouldn't say why she wasn't with him, why they weren't together, where and when they split up. Nothing. Now he's lawyered up. He's refused to help police, and they, in turn, have named him a person of interest. Without Brian to tell us what happened to Gabby, we're left to piece together a digital trail to find out for ourselves if we can. Her final Instagram post was a series of photos taken in front of this butterfly mural. This is next to the Monarch Building in Ogden, Utah, which is an art studio and an event space. This is an important detail because Ogden, Utah is a point between Salt Lake City and Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming. Gabby was last seen checking out of a hotel with Brian in Salt Lake City. That was on August 24th. The following day, August 25th, she made her final phone call to her family, telling them in her voice that she and Laundrie were in Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming. That is the very same day that these photos, taken in Ogden, were posted on her Instagram. Of course, we don't know when the photos were actually taken, but they do seem to indicate that the last known images of Gabby Petito on the cross-country van trip were right there. I'm joined by News Nation's Brian Enten, who has been following this case very closely. So, Brian, person of interest is nothing you want to be when there is a missing young woman. Take me from there.
Yeah, that was the big development today, Ashley. We're outside Brian Laundrie's house right now. We haven't seen him or heard from him, and neither have the police. And today, this afternoon, they officially said he is a person of interest. The detectives, they are frustrated. I have never seen this. This afternoon, the police chief here actually tweeted out publicly to the lawyer for the Laundrie family saying, please make Brian available. Please allow him to talk to us so we can find Gabby. Listen to what the police told me today. We've been outside Brian's house. When the parents come and go, they rush and go. They don't talk to anyone. No one's talking to the police. I mean, why aren't the parents and Brian out saying, please, let's find Gabby?
I'll let you make those assumptions on what you think that means and says. At the current moment, though, we don't have a crime. We have a missing person. We are looking at every avenue necessary to see if this meets any type of criteria for hindering an investigation of a missing person.
So a lot happening behind the scenes right now, Ashley, and police have said flat out there's a lot they are not telling us, and they're not telling the public at this point.
Okay, Brian, I've got up on the screen the police report from Moab, where apparently there was an incident between these two, something domestic. And this is what the responding police officer said when he was talking to this couple. He said, "At no point in my investigation did Gabrielle stop crying, breathing heavily, or compose a sentence without needing to wipe away tears, wipe her nose, or rub her knees with her hands." This was described as an altercation that didn't rise to the occasion of charging them, but did not look good between the two. A lot of comments about the mental health about the two of them. Have you found anything out about that?
Yeah, so the police there basically called this a mental breakdown. This was from August 12th. It all started with a witness by the name of Christopher called police, saw something strange happening with the couple. Police arrived and they said that Gabby was outside the van, apparently locked out of the van, having a breakdown, crying, and that Brian would not let her into the van. It got physical. Police separated them, and you mentioned it, determined that it wasn't a domestic where they needed to make an arrest instead of mental breakdown. What they did in the end is they separated them for the night.
Doesn't look good, though, when she goes missing and there's a moment where he's locking her out of a van and she's climbing through a window to get back in. Brian Enten, live for us in Florida, thank you for that. After the break, I'll be joined by two of Gabby's longtime friends. What was the relationship like between Gabby and Brian before they left on this trip of a lifetime? Welcome back to our special coverage of the search for Gabby Petito. She disappeared on a cross-country van trip with her fiancé, Brian Laundrie. He has refused to help the police with the investigation, and so now he's been named a person of interest. I'm joined by two of Gabby's longtime friends, Nikki Passananti and Stephen Evans. Nikki, I'd just like to start by asking if you have had any updates at all in the search for Gabby.
I mean, there's nothing more than what's already out there and in public. Things are moving very quickly, unfortunately, so it's not too much news.
And Stephen, do you know Brian? Did you get a chance to get to know Brian? I've heard they dated for 2 years before they left on this trip.
So I never actually got to meet him. When they did get engaged, they actually asked me to photograph their wedding. But since then, I never really heard much about him and really know what he even looked like up until now.
What about you, Nikki? Did you know him at all or did you know of him? Did you get a feel for him?
I never got the chance to meet him. I mean, they moved to Florida pretty early in their relationship and we're in Long Island. And yeah, unfortunately, we never got to know a lot. But from what she says and what she posts, they seem to be pretty in love.
Stephen, this must be absolutely maddening that a man who was with her and seemingly having a wonderful time on this trip just all of a sudden shows up back home to his parents' house and there's just no sign of Gabby and he won't say a word. This must be so frustrating.
Absolutely. It's just infuriating. And all I can think of is just, where is she? Like, what does he know? What is he not telling us? Like, all those lines that you've probably heard a million times already. The same thing that Joey keeps saying over and over.
Yeah, the parents just want to keep her pictures up and have people watching for her and looking for her. Nikki, tell me a little bit about the moment that, you know, we've seen these police reports from a moment in Moab in Utah where they were having an argument and it got physical and a witness said that she looked to be locked out of the van. He got into the driver's side and she had to jump in the driver's window, kind of clamoring over him to get back in the van. And, you know, the police had to kind of break them up. What do you make of that?
I mean, it breaks my heart hearing that she was in such distress. I mean, it makes you wonder, like, what did Brian do or say beforehand to make her react that way? I mean, there's so much that we don't know about the situation, and I feel like we're not getting the whole picture from the police report.
Stephen, is there any chance that Gabby is a free spirit and the two of them split up, maybe had an argument, and she went off on her way and she's doing something fun and wonderful and she's out of cell range and maybe, you know, maybe Stephen doesn't know anything about it. Is there any chance for that?
You know, I wish that could be a possibility. I do. She's not a person that would just go off on her own like that. She's an independent person, but not like that. She wouldn't just fall off the grid and not come in contact with family. She would call her parents every day, sometimes a couple times a day. So this is just very, very out of the ordinary.
And you would also think that if that were the case, Brian would say that. Listen, we broke up. We split up, and I don't know where she is. And it is curious, though, right, Nikki? So say that again, Stephen.
That something's just missing. That's just not being told to us, or something. And it's just
there's a real missing piece. Yeah, Nikki, it's her van. That's the other thing that we noted in that police report. That white van is hers. It's registered to her. Is there anything to the decision to get this van together? Did she have it? I'm trying to figure out how the van pieces into this whole trip. Do you know?
I know that she was super excited to get the van, super excited to renovate it and make it perfect for what her and Brian plan to do. And I mean, when you decide to take a trip like this, you know, living out of a van together, spending time in nature so far from home, you're making a vow to look out for each other. And I don't care if you're married, engaged, or you just met, whatever happens on the trip, you stick together. So this,
Stephen, one other thing I wanted to ask you, Stephen, is in the report from the police in Moab, there's all sorts of mention of mental health conditions. And it seems as though that Gabby had some kind of an anxiety. And there were other things that were listed that were redacted. Do you know what her conditions were that she was telling the police she suffered from?
As far as I know, she was just like any one of us at our age. You know, we all have a normal amount of anxiety and a little bit of depression. It's become normal amongst our generation, unfortunately, but nothing out of the ordinary.
But you didn't know anything in terms of, I'm trying to think of what could be, you know, four or five letters that was redacted that both she and Brian suffered from, maybe PTSD or ADHD. Do you know about any conditions like that they both might have suffered from?
I've read that report that. And I'm not aware what that piece that was blurred out was.
Nikki, how is her family doing? You know, I know that they're trying so hard to keep her in the press, but how are they just doing behind the scenes?
They're doing the best they can, the best any parents could do, but there's not much you can ask, you know? It's just, this is the hardest, this is the worst nightmare any parent could possibly have. I don't have kids, but I can only just imagine. I don't even want to imagine it, but it's heartbreaking.
I mean, it's heartbreaking for them. And as friends of Gabby's, I'm sure it's heartbreaking for you as well. Stephen Evans and Nikki Passanante, thank you for being with us. Update us if you hear something. I really do want to continue on this story. Thank you. And a quick programming note, we're going to follow the Alex Murdoch case tomorrow. He is due in court at least at 4. Find out all about that tomorrow on Banfield.